This is an RNIB Connect Radio podcast. Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome into RNIB Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio, first heard here each Tuesday lunchtime at 1, or also available as a podcast. Just ask your smartphone or smart thing to play the latest episode of RNIB Tech Talk. Of course, this is our opportunity as blind and partially sighted people to get together each week and explore the world of technology. We're always keen to hear from you. You can get in touch in the usual way. It's an email, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Coming up this time on Tech Talk, we'll be hearing about RNIB's accessibility and AI event held last week at the new Grimaldi building in London. We'll be speaking with Twi Malyu about becoming a blind talking book producer. Barry Snell has been speaking with a team of researchers hoping to make science more accessible. And Hubert will be back with the next part in his series, Getting Started with VoiceOver on iPhone. So it's a packed show. Stick around for another Tech Talk. A very warm welcome in to our co-hosts, Callum Stoneman, Hubert Pavalkovich. Chaps, it's a busy one this week, so I'm going to...
I know.
So, Callum, just tell me very quickly, what's grabbing your attention in the world of tech this time?
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing more about this RNIB AI event. Obviously, we seem to talk about AI non-stop at the minute, so it's nice to see RNIB getting involved in this. And, yeah, obviously, you attended this a couple of days ago at the time of recording, and it's all quite fresh, so I'm looking forward to just getting into this, really, and seeing what's new there.
Yeah, I think as somebody said, the AI train is leaving the station, and if we're not on board, then we get left behind.
Yeah.
Hubert, what's on your mind?
I've seen this recently, and it's, if you're a fan of Zoom recorders, these handheld digital voice recorders, which are fairly affordable as voice recorders are concerned, there is a talking range of these recorders coming out in the second quarter of 2024. I believe they'll be known as the Zoom H6, which will have talking menus.
Ah, exciting stuff.
Nice.
There we are. Well, we'll be looking into that when those products become available. Range of prices there, though, I think it's fair to say, with Zoom, because the H1 is probably the most affordable. That's about £80, I think, and then they go up from there. And some of them do get a bit more expensive, I think.
Yes, I believe so. It'll be interesting to see how much the price tag will increase with the talking menus feature, if that will increase the price tag, which I imagine it might.
Alrighty, well, stick around. It's another Tech Talk. Last week, RNIB hosted an event concerning accessibility and AI at the Grimaldi Building in London. I was there for Tech Talk and managed to catch up with some of the attendees to get their reactions and reflections on how artificial intelligence can make the world more accessible for blind and partially sighted people. I'm with Robin Spinks, who is RNIB's Inclusive Design Lead. Robin, you've been one of the architects of this event. What are we hoping for from today?
Dave, I think we're all recognising that artificial intelligence is very rapidly becoming part of the fabric of modern life, and it really is that big a deal. So, you know, ignore it at your peril. AI is actually infiltrating every area of life, whether it's going to the cinema, buying a train ticket, getting guidance, parking your car. There's so many different things AI is actually coming into play. And what we wanted to do was really bring together stakeholders with an interest in AI, get some conversations and collaborations underway, and really embrace what is happening in the fast, ever-changing world of technology, and above all else, to do that in a way that's beneficial to blind and partially sighted people here in the UK and further afield.
You mentioned stakeholders. Who's here today?
Today we've got around 60 delegates. Apparently we're at capacity. We had to turn people away, which is a good problem to have. We've got companies as diverse as Apple and Google and Virgin Media, and EY. We've got companies who are working in the AI space. We've got startups. We've got universities. We've got a whole range of organisations and some of our own trustees and staff. And really, it's about galvanising the conversation, bringing people together, embracing this massive transformation and revolution that's happening in society, which AI is at the heart of, and looking at how can we do that in ways that are beneficial for blind people. That's what it's all about, creating an uplift in quality of life. Today's the start of the conversation, and I'm super excited.
What do you perceive as being the greatest opportunity for us as blind and partially sighted people? We've heard a lot over the last year about technology describing images. That's just one use case, isn't it?
It is, and it's super exciting. I think for me, the kind of rapid development of multimodal AI, so the kind of AI that you can show something to, you can speak to it, you can present it with a situation, you can maybe even show it video. I'm really excited about the potential of that particular dimension in AI to create not just change today and change tomorrow, but lasting, impactful change that actually begins to create a greater sense of equity and, you know, level the playing field so that we're not constantly battling with technology and systems and feeling excluded. Actually, the opportunity should be, how can I use this technology in a way that works for me today and recognizes and embraces my needs? That's what it's all about, factoring in the diversity of human need and making sure that people can progress, they can learn, they can study, they can socialize, they can do the things they want to do without barriers. That, at the end of the day, is what it's all about.
I'm joined by Ben from UCL. Ben, just what attracted you to this event? Why did you come along today?
Sort of dual remits in my role of trying to make sure all of our content is as accessible as possible by design. A lot of that's about raising awareness in building accessibility kind of good practice and thinking into the way that we design systems, the way we procure digital systems. But I'm really interested in the role that AI can play. Most public sector organisations are pretty big, and what they do is create information. So there's a lot of information flowing around the place, and it's very difficult to kind of breathe on every bit of information to ensure that accessibility is part of a user's end-to-end journey. So I'm really interested to see how AI can help us to maximise the ability to provide accessible by design materials in everything we do, because there's a lot of really goodwill. People are incredibly motivated. UCL is a fantastically kind of inclusive organisation, but there's an issue with scale, you know, about the amount of information people create. And I think where AI may be able to help us to prioritise some of those workflows and to make the most impactful and kind of important things accessible in the right order. Obviously we want everything to be beautifully accessible, but you know, there's a sustainability angle here and what's realistically possible. And I think where AI can help do some of that heavy lifting, then that would just be, you know, brilliant to explore. And that's what I'm really excited about, and I've learned so much today from the brilliant speakers we've had.
I'm joined by Seema Flower, who of course you will know as the Managing Director of Blind Ambition. Welcome to Connect Radio, Seema. You, this afternoon, were part of the panel.
Yes, thank you so much, and it's a great honour to be here at this really exciting event.
Tell me, Seema, you know, you're all about empowering blind and partially sighted people to basically grab hold of life and really go out there and be the best version of ourselves. What role do you see AI having in your work?
I think, well, in my work, I think if it goes really, really well, you know, it'll be really, really good in terms of revolutionising and collaborating the role of a support worker in terms of accuracy and speed. And where I see it in terms of working with people as individuals who are visually impaired, it will really empower them and accelerate their lives in terms of actually giving them more independence and more autonomy.
Let's just unpack that support worker piece, because there has been this suggestion that there are elements of support work that potentially AI could do. Just tell me, in your view, which bits do you think AI could do and which bits do we still need a human for?
So the bits that the AI could do in terms of a support worker, it would be, say, for example, maybe running through emails, sifting through, spotting the ones that are really, really important, reading those out, and then getting responses compiled for them using voice activation. And then the support worker, that support worker could be actually supporting you in more complex roles where you need a bit more of a human touch. So, for example, maybe going to events in terms of networking, but also helping with different types of research and maybe assisting taking notes where you are in confidential meetings, for example, like coaching or careers interviews.
You are known for your fantastic seminars on employment, offering blind and partially sighted people skills and tips and knowledge and motivation to really enable us to succeed in the workplace. Are you going to be including AI as part of that package?
I will be, basically. I will be doing that going forward, because I think it's such a huge a part of our future. It's already in existence now, but sometimes people are not so aware of it. But it's a space that's growing, basically, and it's only going to improve our lives. I think it's important that people in the visually impaired community are actually aware of it and how they're going to be able to embrace it and work with it, rather than actually seeing it as a potential threat, maybe, or they might be thinking it might be difficult for them to health and safety. We need to embrace it for what it is and utilise it effectively to enhance and make our lives more efficient.
Indeed, and often that is it, isn't it? It's about efficiency, tools like Copilot or describing images. How do we ensure, though, that we don't let our sighted colleagues off the hook when it comes to making information accessible? I would hate for anyone to come away from an event like this thinking, oh, well, blind people have got AI now, they don't need me to describe images or lay out this document. And you and I, of course, know that's not true.
I think with, in terms of the sort of regulations, the global regulations and compliance around accessibility, I think they still need to be adhered to. I think this will just be icing on the cake. Yeah, it needs to be seen as an addition. It's not a replacement.
I'm with Anna Tyler, Chair of the Board of Trustees for RNIB. Anna, thank you so much for your time and for being here this afternoon. Just share with listeners, if you would, you made an interesting point earlier about mainstream technology and about making sure that that is as accessible as it should be and how important that is.
Yes, I think that AI offers lots of opportunities. So let's just set aside the fact that blind people are early adopters of artificial intelligence. But the opportunities that are presented from where we are now to develop all kinds of tools which can be mainstreamed. So if you think about the way that the world operates now, how we live now, there are so many things that we take for granted in society, like facial recognition, like ocular character recognition, all of which had their origins in early adoption by sight loss community. These were solutions that we actively went out and sought to help us read, to help us navigate the world. And now we find this is your gateway to the lounge by the gate at the airport. Everybody's using this tech. We're early adopters. And I think it's absolutely vital for us to make sure that our voice is heard, that we're involved in conversations about risk, around governance, around the future developments of products, to stretch our tentacles out into all kinds of areas, so that we take this opportunity to ensure that we continue that tradition of inclusivity in the work that we and others are doing to develop artificial intelligence. It doesn't have to be a niche product for blind and partially sighted people. I think the point here is it's an opportunity to have real parity, real equity, whether you're blind, partially sighted, or fully sighted.
Our very own Dave Williams there from the RNIB's AI event in London last week. So how was it? What were the big takeaways from that then? It seems like, you know, quite a lot of speakers, a lot of things going on there, Dave.
Well, we talk about AI, obviously, on a regular basis here. So we're quite close to it. And you think you've heard about all the use cases until you haven't. I was interested to learn a little bit about large action models. So right now, the current generation of AI is largely concerned with these large language models that essentially take lots and lots and lots of text and a kind of try to use that and apply that to describe images, answer questions. You know, it's sort of like talking to a library in a way, I suppose, is one way to describe it. But Ant Morse there, he was talking about large action models. So the next generation will have lots and lots of things that your AI can do. So it might be, you know, booking some travel or making some arrangements or sending some messages on your behalf. So much more kind of active. The other area that was interesting is how AI is being used to support safety and well-being in the workplace. So imagine you're working in a customer service role, for example. If a customer was a bit obnoxious towards you, AI could step in and say, look, this is not how you speak to our staff. So lots of interesting use cases.
That is interesting.
Yeah. And fantastic, yeah. Actually, to have people from across the sort of the VI sector. You know, there was a trustee there from Sight for Surrey, for example. Lots of blind and partially sighted people in the room speaking directly with representatives from the technology industry, and those dialogues are very important, you know, opportunity for networking, collaborating. Hopefully, you know, we're going to get to test more stuff and hopefully shape the direction of travel a little bit.
Yeah, sounds really, really interesting. It's a mixture of interesting and terrifying, isn't it? Especially these large action models. Actually, AI being able to book you a ticket or even control your home. I suppose we're used to saying to our smart speakers, you know, turn on the lights or turn off the plugs and things like that. But actually having AI with so much more, you know, essentially being able to just talk to your home through ChatGPT, for example, is slightly bizarre. But, you know, that's where we're heading.
Well, I think where the big technology companies are concerned, they are very mindful of the risks, and they talk a lot about guardrails and safeguards and trying to be, you know, responsible and doing this in a kind of an ethical way, making sure that, for example, blind people are not misrepresented when it comes to large language models. And so the big tech, you know, they're all using that sort of language around guardrails. You know, we've heard that before here on Tech Talk. Jenny Lay Flurry, I think, talked about guardrails. Chris Patno from Google. So we've heard that. I guess the thing we need to be cautious of is entities that we've not heard of, you know, potentially rogue players operating in this space. So I think like any technology, you know, it's important to learn about it. Ant Morse's call to action is to actually block out some time in your diary and just go and, you know, Google the heck out of a subject. And of course, other search engines are available, right? And just, you don't have to become a data scientist. We've got data scientists for that. But just go and educate yourself and learn what's out there, what's possible, and what you need to do to stay safe.
Hubert, what do you make of all this?
I mean, I like the sound of the large action models, but equally, it is a terrifying concept. But I will also say it is great to see these things develop, because I've seen, you know, various benefits of AI, and we all have seen them. You know, we've seen the Be My AI feature and Be My Eyes and many other features. So to see this technology and what it can do in the future and what it could be capable of, if we look at the positive side of it, it would be fantastic. And it is important equally to have these guardrails and to be mindful of, you know, maintaining this technology and making sure that it only does ideally what we want it to do and nothing more than that. But yeah, the large action models, to me, that part sounds quite intriguing. And I certainly would like to see that and would like to see how it works and how far that can be pushed, and equally, obviously, how much control does the user still have over that, which I think is essential. It's maintaining that control with the user rather than AI.
I think the other thing to perhaps finish on is that historically, blind and partially sighted people have been at the forefront of technology. Think of the talking book or optical character recognition that many of us were using in the 80s for scanning documents. A lot of that technology now is commonplace and mainstream. And so it is fantastic that we have this sort of accessibility application of AI just now. And that gives us this opportunity to have a seat at the table, to have a voice and be part of the conversation as this technology evolves.
Certainly a lot going on. What do you make of it all? Are you interested? Are you excited? Or are you trying your best to run away from it? Let us know your thoughts. techtalk@rnib.org.uk.
Hello and welcome to the next episode of our Getting Started with VoiceOver series, looking at Apple's very own VoiceOver screen reader built into various Apple devices and giving you a bit of a taster as to how it works in different areas. So this is episode 5. We've looked at many things in the last few episodes, including basic gestures, essential gestures, navigation, the rotor, and enabling and learning VoiceOver. Today, we will look at web browsing. It's sort of a follow-up from the rotor episode, mainly because what I will show you is how important the rotor is when web browsing. So if you want to know how the rotor works, feel free to listen on the podcast to our previous episode of Tech Talk, where I give you a demonstration of how the rotor works. I won't cover too much in this episode because we've done it previously, so I will only mention a few different things. So the rotor is important in web browsing for many reasons, and one of the main ones is simply to navigate a web page quicker. What I've put together here is an example. So I've got Safari opened.
Apps widget. Safari active. Action. Safari. Skip to main content. In page link banner. Landmark.
So we are on the RNIB Connect Radio website here. So there are multiple ways you can navigate a website. You can either swipe left or right with one finger and go through every single element on the web page, or you can move your finger around the screen and you'll be told what you are touching. Or you can use the rotor. Now, the advantage of using the rotor is you will get to skip through large chunks of the web page without having to explore every single little element if you actually know roughly what you are looking for. At the moment, if I swipe right with one finger, I will be going through every single link, every single image, every element on the webpage. Have a listen.
Switch color mode button, collapse. RNIB home page, link, image, menu toggle button, collapse. Search this website button, end, home, link, list start. RNIB Connect Radio, heading level 1. Now playing. The afternoon edition. Play button. Audio. Mute button. Volume level 100%. Adjust. Remaining time. 0. Picture in picture. Dimmed button. On next. 6 p.m. : Highlights. A large black radio studio mic with RNIB Connect Radio written on it in pink. Screens and a desk in a radio studio are shown in the background. Image. Possible text, RNIB Connect Radio.
So as you've heard there, I was going through every single element on the web page when, for example, what I really want is further down the web page, and it will take me a while to get there. Now, there is a way to do it easier, and that is using the rotor. I am currently back at the top of the RNIB Connect Radio web page. Now, what I said to you about the rotor in the last episode was that when you open certain apps, what you see in your rotor can be different. So in the rotor I showed you in the last episode of this series, I had items such as characters, words, speaking rate, sounds, language, headings, few other things like that. Now I will show you what I've got in my rotor in this case. Some of these things will be the same as the last one. that we saw in episode 4, but you will find there's a few more elements here. So let's go through the rotor. I will put two fingers on the screen and rotate clockwise to the right.
Form controls. Tables. Visited links. Buttons. Buttons. Text fields. Vertical navigation. Screen recognition. Describe images. Edit. Actions. Characters. Words. Text selection. Speaking rate. Lines. Sounds. Language. Diff. Headings. Form controls.
So you've seen that items like form controls, tables, visited links, buttons, and text fields have appeared. These were not there when we were on the home screen. So the good thing is, if you are somewhere where these elements can be spotted, then your rotor will automatically have them added and they will disappear again if you don't actually need them. Or if you are somewhere where there's no elements like that. For example, if you go back to the home screen, form controls, tables, and all the elements I've mentioned before won't be there because you won't need them. So how do you navigate a web page quicker with the rotor? So let me go through headings.
Headings. 13 headings.
So I've gone to headings and VoiceOver helpfully told me there's 13 headings, and I can swipe up or down with one finger to go through the various headings. And that will basically help me to skip a large chunk of the web page without having to read every single element. So let's swipe down.
RNIB Connect Radio, heading level 1, page content, main, landmark.
So as you can see, we've already skipped a few links that you've heard before and have gone straight to the main heading of the web page.
RNIB Connect Radio Schedule, heading level 3, link.
As you can hear again, we have skipped even more of the web page to go to what we want. So it's a much quicker way of navigating. If you know what you're looking for especially, this will make web browsing a whole lot easier because you won't have to go through that painful task of going through every single element when you don't actually need to do it. So if I swipe down again,
RNIB Connect Radio Shows, heading level 3, link.
It goes to the next heading, which is the radio shows that are broadcast on Connect Radio. And if I swipe back up with one finger,
RNIB Connect Radio Schedule, heading level 3, link.
We go back to the RNIB Connect Radio Schedule. So let's double tap on that link.
RNI skip to main content, in page link banner, landmark.
So it has now opened that website. And again, I don't want to really go through the whole process of going through all the links. So I will go through headings once again.
Explore what's coming up on RNIB Connect Radio, heading level 1, page content, main, landmark. RNIB Connect Radio Schedule, heading level 2. Contents, heading level 2, pages in this section, navigation, landmark, call our helpline on, heading level 2, content, 0303, call our helpline on, contents, heading level 2, m-dash, list start, explore what's coming up on RNIB Connect, m-dash, Monday, link, m-dash, Tuesday, link.
So now I am exploring with one finger because I am looking for a link to a specific day, for example. So we have Tuesday here.
Tuesday, link.
Let's double tap.
Tuesday, link. Explore what's coming up on RNIB Connect Radio. M-dash.
Now let's find headings again.
7, morning talking books, heading level 2.
And now we can go through headings to read what's coming up.
8, highlights, heading level 2.
And if you want to find out more about a show, you can swipe to the right with one finger to see what elements are under this heading.
Great features, interviews and music from RNIB Connect Radio. Listen to highlights, link. 9, The Daily Connect, heading level 2. The voice of the RNIB community. Listen to The Daily Connect, link.
And I'll go through headings once again.
12, Folk and Roots, heading level 2. 13, Tech Talk, heading level 2.
Oh look, Tech Talk. Let's see what this is about, shall we?
The best tech for the blind and partially sighted. Listen to Tech Talk, link. 14, Talking Books, heading level 2. 15, The Afternoon Edition, heading level 2. 18, Children's Talking Books, heading level 2. 19, Highlights, heading level 2. 22, Talking Books, heading level 2. 23, Relax with RNIB Connect Radio, heading level 2. Relax with great music to end the day. Listen to Relax with RNIB. Previous page Monday, link, list start. Next page Wednesday, link, list end. End, pagination, navigation. End, page content, main, next document.
So that was a much quicker web browsing experience, which the Rota makes even easier. And headings is just one of the elements. If you are, for example, looking for a table, if you know there's a table on this web page that you are looking for, you can use the Rota to find tables and swipe up or down with one finger to navigate to a table. Or if you are looking for a specific button, you can go to buttons in the Rota and find that button that way. Same goes for text fields. So it does speed web browsing up quite a bit. Equally, if you want to still browse through every single element you can, but if you want a faster web browsing experience, the Rota is definitely very helpful in that case. So I hope you've enjoyed this episode. In the next part of the series, we will be looking at text, and that is reading text and text editing, where the Rota, again, can come in quite handy too. So hopefully you can join me then. But if you have any more questions about what you are hearing, do drop us an email. It's that usual email address, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That is techtalk@rnib.org.uk. And we'll be more than happy to answer any questions you may have about what you've heard in this fifth episode of the VoiceOver series or anything else we mention on the show. Happy web browsing.
Brian F. Shaw, PhD and Professor of Chemistry and Biochemistry at Baylor University, joins me now to discuss his latest and first-of-its-kind research, which hopes to make hard scientific data available to students with blindness. So thanks for joining us, Professor Shaw.
Great to be with you.
So this new research, it involves using tactile lithophane. Can you tell us more about what that is, please?
Yes, so lithophanes they're really an ancient art form. They were probably developed in the 7th century in China. And They're thin, translucent engravings, like a picture that you can feel. But when you hold it up to the light, a room light or sunlight, you get light scattering that produces a picture-perfect rendering of the tactile image. So basically, you can have a picture that you can touch or one that you can see. And so it's a universal data format.
And combining the past and the future to make something new, that's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is funny. We didn't intentionally do that. We accidentally made these lithophanes in our lab, and we thought actually we might have developed them first. For about a week, we're like, oh, wow, look at this. And then we figured out, oh, no, these have been around for over a millennium.
Now, this has had a lot of media coverage around the world. What stage is it at the moment, Professor Shaw?
Well, we're producing these and we're using them to help high school people with blindness and graduate students and undergraduates and postdoctoral fellows with blindness, as well as professors with blindness. We're using them to help these folks visualize their data, examine, look at, and perceive their data. We're in the real world phase.
And what's the feedback been like from the blind and partially sighted community so far? And where do you see this going? How big could this get?
Well, the first person with blindness that we gave these to was Dr. Hobie Wedler. And he just was very excited to be able to feel noise in data for the first time. Something as simple as noise. Noise is important when you're looking at a spectrum or something. But to be able to visualize an SDS page gel or some other data format that he always heard about, or maybe had some simple schematic tactile format of, to be able to actually feel the data at the exact same resolution that a sighted person sees it, he freaked out. I mean, it was great. And we got it on video, and he let us put it on YouTube. So the response has been very exciting, and watching the high school kids, the secondary school kids, be able to feel things for the first time at high resolution, like microscopic images of butterfly wings or insects, it's pretty cool. So they're quite happy. I'd like to push this into children's books and science books for kids. with visual impairments or without them. So making universal children's books centering around science that sighted or blind kids can read or look at, or that parents can read or look at with their kids. So I'd like it to go towards that.
That would be incredible. And it's personal to you as well, because I believe your son was diagnosed with retinoblastoma when he was just an infant.
My son Noah, he was born with big tumors in both of his eyes. He had bilateral retinoblastoma, so he lost one eye at 9 months old, and his other eye had a 7-millimeter tumor in the center of his field of vision, and two smaller 1-millimeter tumors. And we did quite a bit of treatment to salvage vision in that eye. And he has okay vision, but some of his friends don't. Some of his friends lost both of their eyes, people that we met through this ordeal. And so, yeah, that's how I got into this.
Well, we wish you lots of luck with the tactile little pain, and the fact, as you've mentioned, blind and partially sighted people are already gravitating towards it and see the potential. It's exciting times. How can people find out more about the research?
They can go to shawlaboratory.com, or they can email me, BRYAN_SHAW@Baylor.edu. Or they can Google lithophane in science, and that'll give them tons of information. If your listeners would like to learn more about lithophanes, they can check out our recent paper in Science Advances. The title of it is Universal Pictures: A Lithophane Codex Helps Blind Teenagers Visualize Nanoscopic Systems.
Professor Brian F. Shaw, thanks very much for your time on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks, Barry.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, or tweet at RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
Sound Without Sight is a community hub to support, promote, and connect blind and partially sighted musicians and audio engineers. And Twi Malalyu, I hope I got that right, is an audio producer working with RNIB in our Talking Books studio. Welcome, Twi. Great to speak with you. Have you always wanted to become an audio producer?
Well, it's an interesting question, Dave, because I've always been interested in sound and music and all things audio generally. When I was younger, I used to kind of do these mock interviews and record, you know, and bug my brother and sister like crazy, interviewing them about just nothing in particular, and creating dramas and, you know, sort of doing all the sound effects and things. So I've always had an interest in sounds, and that's how I got into music. That's how I got into learning the piano, for instance, because I discovered that, you know, when you press the sustain pedal down and you shout into it, it kind of reverberates because of the strings with sympathetic resonance and everything. So I've always had an interest in producing sounds one way or another. But obviously, the role of audio producer is quite a recent development, and so I've not known that that's what I wanted to do, but it's basically been leaning that way, you know, sort of moving towards that.
And how did you go from shouting into the piano to really starting more seriously to explore how you might work in this field?
I got interested in music technology, and when I left school, I went to study music and technology at university. So I got into recording then, and I set up as a freelance kind of musician, audio engineer, and I kind of had my own studio in my home. And, you know, recorded people doing their GCSE, your sort of music projects and things like that. So I got into recording at that stage, but it's interesting how I got into audio producing for Talking Books specifically, because I actually applied for the job of, I think they probably called it recording engineer or something like that at the time, and I didn't get the job, so that was a little bit disappointing for me. But then in my interview for the job, the studio manager at the time, he seemed to think that there would be an opening for someone like me, because I just got into digital recording using a hard disk recorder. But at the time, they were just recording the Talking Books onto reel-to-reel tapes, and they were wanting to move over to a digital system using computer-based digital audio workstations. And they thought that there'd be a job for me to make that accessible for a blind recording engineer. And so they created a job for me. And so that's how I got into the Talking Book studios.
I just want to back up a little bit. You mentioned going to university, and did you went on a course there to study audio engineering?
Yes, I did a degree in music and technology.
And where was that?
In at City University in London.
And how was that experience from an accessibility point of view?
That was really interesting, because I remember one of the first things I had to do was have an interview with the person who was potentially going to be my tutor. And I think it was supposed to have lasted for like 5 or 10 minutes, but it ended up being half an hour or longer, with me trying to persuade him the fact that even though I was blind, I wasn't going to be tripping over mic cables and mic stands and all that kind of thing, because he was really worried that it would be like a health and safety kind of hazard, because I was the first blind person to study there on that course.
And how did you persuade him?
I don't know. I think I just explained that, you know, it's not like being able to navigate and find your way around. That was, you know, I was quite good at that. And I think I managed to persuade him of the fact that I wasn't likely to be crashing into things all the time.
So it was that the mechanics of how you were going to get in and stuff, yeah, like that yes, they were concerned about, not the tools.
Yeah, I think it was more, yeah. There was no, I don't think they were concerned about, you know, sort of not being able to use the equipment, because it was all analog then. It was, you know, big, large form, you know, sort of consoles and 24-track, you know, sort of 2-inch tape, reel-to-reel 2-inch tapes. So, I mean, there wasn't access issues there. Whereas when it became digital, then you did get into, you know, sort of more difficulties. But we did also work in pairs. So quite often I'd team up with a sighted person and we'd do the recordings together. So we'd take, you know, digital recorders around with us to different venues and set up microphones and stuff and record orchestras. And so that was good, because you were able to collaborate with someone. And I ended up sort of sitting in the control room, listening to the speakers, telling him where to move the mics, you know, just an inch or so one way or another, raise it up a bit, you know, just to get the best kind of mic placement.
Right, because sighted producers often are looking at, you know, waveform or level meters, things like that.
Yes, so obviously I was able to get him to check the levels for me, because those weren't like hard disk recorders or digital tape, you know, DAT machines. So there wasn't any way of measuring the level of those systems. at the time. So the fact that we worked in pairs was quite useful for me. And, you know, being able to access material, books and things, I'd often buy the book and then he'd read it onto tape for me or something like that and then keep the copy of the book. So it was, we always found workarounds for that.
And so you finished at City University. You mentioned that you became a freelance producer. Was that a choice, Twi, or was that something that you felt you were forced to do because it was difficult to get into the industry?
I don't think I kind of made a concerted effort to get into the industry. I just sort of, you know, like you do when you kind of choose your A levels and choose your degree. I kind of stumbled into it, the music and recording course, because I couldn't think of anything else to do, you know, because those were things that I liked and I was interested in. But I mean, had I been a bit more forward thinking, I probably could have done a maths degree or something that would get me into a career that, you know, in accountancy or something like that. But I didn't think at the time. I just enjoyed music and recording and stuff, and so it just happened. Then when I finished the course, I just thought, oh, I'll get myself a recording, some recording equipment, and start recording people.
And were you successful as a freelancer, or was it all a bit stop start?
It was, you know, stop start. You couldn't really make a living from it. You know, it would be because I was playing in bands and freelancing, you know, recording in the studio. So it was a kind of, you had to combine lots of different things really to make enough money. Oh, and teaching music.
So you became aware of this role at RNIB. The first interview, you said you didn't get the gig, but then they kind of created a role.
That's right, yeah. And so I kind of got in through the back door, effectively. And so they decided to use Sadie Digital Audio Workstation, because that was what they were using in the BBC at the time. And basically they let me loose on a Sadie machine, and then every so often I'd get a sighted producer would be able to give me some help in terms of telling me what's on the screen and whereabouts and stuff. And I kind of tried to use, you know, JAWS, the screen reader, JAWS has got like a scripting language. And I tried to develop scripts that would help you move the mouse to the right part of the screen and click on it and tell you the value and stuff like that for the timeline reading and sample rate and all those kinds of things. And so I created these scripts so that the blind recording engineer could operate the Sadie system.
So you used JAWS scripting to try and work around some of the accessibility barriers that you were experiencing with the Sadie software. Was scripting something that you self-taught? Most JAWS users don't ever get around to scripting.
Yes, it was, because, you know, I was fascinated by things like that. I've always been into techie kind of things, so it just kind of came naturally, really. I did do like some computer studies and things at school, but it was fairly basic. It's, you know, pretty elementary stuff that you're just moving the mouse around, and there's call up different functions for moving the mouse and speaking the what's under it and clicking it and stuff. So it's almost like a macro recorder.
And were there any other barriers that you encountered early in your career in terms of access to technology, or even attitudinal barriers, people's expectations of what you might or might not be able to do?
I think that because it was the RNIB, I think they were quite understanding of difficult, you know, any issues that I might potentially have had. Things like, for instance, access to the script, to the book, the text, because they were working with hard copies. So there was no way that we could actually follow. As a blind producer, you couldn't follow the text. You could only pretty much know that they'd made a mistake because it didn't make sense, or they said the wrong word or something like that. And even to know which books you were working on, that they had a system of box files with the book and the credits and all that kind of stuff in the box. And there wasn't any way of knowing what the project was that you're working on. So I had to use things like KNFB reader at the time on the phone, and I just scanned the label on the box file, and then I'd know which project I was working on, but I wouldn't be able to follow the text. And that's only been possible since we've been able to get the electronic versions of the texts.
Describe your current working environment then, Twi. What software and hardware tools do you use, including any assistive technology?
Well, obviously I used JAWS screen reader on a Windows computer, and we're running the SADI software, and then I'm also using a braille display to be able to read the text, so I can follow the electronic text. I can follow along with the sighted narrator. And I also have a hardware controller which helps me operate the SADI system, so I can rewind and play and record and, you know, put cuts in the audio to know where I'm going to edit and things like that.
Can you explain your workflow on a typical project? What sort of production techniques would you be relying on? You know, describe a little bit about how you would go about recording, editing, mastering, and meeting your deadlines.
It's quite a sort of straightforward workflow. You find out which book you're working on. You download the text for it. You create a project inside SADI for that book, and then you record it. And obviously when they make a mistake, you stop the recording and you go back and cue them in, play the audio from a little bit before, and then when it comes to the bit that they made the mistake, you drop it into record. So it's like punch and roll editing. And then you finish the recording, and you have to combine all the edits so that, you know, that it depends on how many mistakes they make. You group them all together, and then you form chapter chunks, as it were, from that. And then you split the book up into the different chapters and the sections. And then you have to master it, so you bring it up to a decent level, and using plugins on SADI which aren't accessible for me, so I have to I have a support worker who's able to control my machine, and I tell him what plugin to put in where and change the parameters, to get him to tell me what the level is and everything. So then you master that and you bounce it all out, and then you import it into a DAISY production, which is the Digital Accessible Information System, which is the standard for audiobooks for the blind. Basically MP3s that are tagged with XML headings, so that you can be able to split up a book into the different levels of navigation. So say if you have a book that's in parts and chapters, and then you can jump through, navigate through the book by part or by chapter and skip different sections, whatever. So that's in the DAISY production thing. So you convert that into a DAISY project, and then you upload that to the server.
And what other audio production tools have you tried, and can you sort of comment as to their accessibility?
At home, I have an Apple Mac computer, and I'm running Logic on that, and that's quite good because, you know, it's fairly accessible out of the box, and it works with Mac and VoiceOver and everything. But I can't really envisage using that for audiobook production. It's more of a music production package, and it's good for people, you know, songwriters and people like that who kind of writing songs from scratch. They've got loads of loops and sounds and ideas that they can just put together and create music, and that's really accessible. But from a audiobook perspective, I think it would be quite tricky to make that accessible just by in terms of the way that it splits things up, you know, it splits them up into regions, and then when you put a cut, you split the region, and so it's really convoluted for audiobooks.
And at work, you mentioned some of the plugins that you need to use are not accessible, and so you rely on a support worker to help with those. Have you tried to reach out at all to the developers to see if accessibility improvements can be made? I assume they can't be scripted then if you're using a support worker.
No, well, I think it's just because it was for time reasons. I didn't have the time to actually script them because I was actually having to use them straight away, kind of thing. Whereas before I was able to script because, you know, I wasn't having to use it on the coalface, as it were. But now, and I don't think I would be able to. I think it would be too high a level of scripting for me, because my knowledge is very basic on that. But I think it's mainly the problems are with Sadie, because they haven't really developed the program for quite a long time now. It's mainly because I think the things like Isotope and stuff, they are fairly accessible as plugins, and you can use them in Reaper and things like that. But because we're using Sadie, I think that's where the lack of accessibility to the plugins happens within Sadie itself.
Have you done much with Reaper? It's quite popular, isn't it?
Yeah, I want to get into it more, and I've had a little bit of a dabble, and we've got it installed on my machine now, so I plan to look into that a bit more, because we may have to, you know, sort of move to Reaper to use as our DAW. So I want to get familiar with that. And I know people who are using it, you know, at quite a high level at the moment, so I'm looking forward to learning that.
And what do you think are some of the specific challenges that blind and partially sighted people often face when trying to get a career in the audio production industry?
I think it's probably mainly in accessibility, and it's trying to get workarounds. I think that there are always workarounds, even if something can't be made accessible. You can maybe do things differently so that it, you know, you can still achieve the end goal, as it were. So I think it's trying to find workarounds, and I always like that. It's a kind of problem solving scenario, isn't it? So if you've got a particular problem, then to try and find a way, you know, to get around it.
And you've been quite tenacious in developing lots of skills to support that. You taught yourself to do a bit of JAWS scripting. You obviously have optimised your Braille reading skills. And you know, sometimes you'll just grab a support worker. So you're prepared to do whatever it takes.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's not to be too kind of proud. I think, you know, to admit when you do need help and to be willing to, because I think, you know, sometimes I'll say to the sighted narrators, I'll say, I'm really struggling to keep up with your reading. But maybe if we sort of do it in a more measured way, it might be easier for the person to listen to the book. And so they'll pace themselves and then they think, oh, yeah, that's quite good, you know. And so I think that there are ways around it. And I think it's just being flexible and being able to, and you know, admitting when there are situations that you really can't cope with and you need a pair of eyes on it, really.
Anything I've not asked you? Any final thoughts, hints, tips? What would you say to young people trying to make their way in this field?
I'd just say kind of go for it. If you love sound and producing, you know, audio and stuff like that, just go for any jobs and then get around the obstacles and the hurdles when you're there. Find workarounds. I think you know, if you kind of think about it enough, there'll be ways to get around things.
Tweet Malalieu, audio producer with RNIB Talking Books. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it from Tech Talk this week. Thank you so much for your company, as ever. You can get in contact with us in the usual way, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. We're always delighted to hear from you, and we do read each and every message, so do get in contact. But from myself, Dave Williams, Hubert Pavalkovich, and Callum Stoneman, until next time, bye for now.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.